Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more. Straight talk, no nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
March 6th, 2015. Good morning, Talking Law fans. This is your host, Dan Hochheiser, criminal defense attorney in New York, broadcasting to you live from Lower Manhattan, just east of the Freedom Tower. We have a great show today. Talking Law Radio is a show which seeks to entertain, educate, and include our listeners in the conversation about the important legal issues of the day. Every week we bring you a great guest. Today is no different. We have a great guest for you. I'll tell you about him later. Please follow the show on facebook.com/talkinglaw. Please follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, Hochheiser. You can listen to all our prior episodes on blogtalkradio.com/talkinglaw. You can also listen to all our prior episodes on iTunes. Our show last week was fantastic. It was an interview of author George Anastasia, who wrote a book, Gotti's Rules, the story of John Alite, Junior Gotti, and the demise of the American Mafia. Please check out that show on blogtalkradio.com/talkinglaw or download it on iTunes. It's worth a listen to learn about the current state of the American Mafia. Today's show is fantastic. We have John Alite, who is the subject and the source for George Anastasia's book, Gotti's Rules. Gotti's Rules is really a story about John Alite's life in the mob and his contacts with the Gambino family, including the Gottis. So without further ado, let me introduce John Alite. John Alite was a former associate of the Gambino family who worked as an enforcer for John Gotti Jr. and others for approximately 25 years of his life in the mafia. He served time in prison in both Brazil and in the United States for his crimes, and ultimately cooperated with the government and left that life. And now I bring you John Alite. Mr. Alite, are you with me?
Yeah, I am. How are you, Dan?
I'm doing okay. May I call you John?
Yep, you may.
Thank you very much. Thanks for taking the time this morning. I do appreciate it. Before we go further, I understand you have a website, johnalite.com, johnalite.com. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the website, what resources they can get from there, and why you created the site?
Well, I created the site to do some motivational speaking and to help kids not follow on the same path that I did and go down the wrong road. So I do a lot of talking and engagements and reach out to kids that don't have the confidence, I guess, and lose their way a little bit, as if the way I did. And hopefully I can change their minds and give them a better insight of what the future is like, and it's not as glamorous as everybody thinks. And also I do a little bit of consulting and, you know, try to reach out to parents that don't know how to reach their kids.
And let's, before we get to what you're doing now and the future, let's go way back to your childhood, before you ever met John Gotti Jr., before you knew anything about the Gambinos. Where did you grow up? What did your parents do? Where were your parents from?
I'm an Albanian nationality. My father was born there in Albania, Tirana. My mom was born in Pittsburgh. My dad was a cab driver. So I came from, a lower middle class upbringing in Woodhaven, Queens, off of Jamaica Avenue.
Okay, and there came a time, well, your childhood was my understanding is, sort of normal, and you actually did okay in school and played baseball and went to college. Tell us about that journey and your budding baseball career.
Well, I was my father was a big guy on athletic, athleticism. But I wasn't a great scholar in school, and I didn't study much. But I went through because of my baseball. So baseball carried me into a high school, which I became the captain of the baseball team. I played varsity all 4 years. I was a junior and senior captain of the team, which in turn turned me into I played in almost any league, every league that you could possibly think of that was out of the area. So I played for Long Island Mets, the Flushing Tigers. I played for all kinds of travel teams, all-star baseball player on most teams. And I got a scholarship to University of Tampa. And from there, my life changed a little bit. I had an arm injury, and I gave up schooling, and I went into the street.
Was just before we get into the street, were you the caliber of baseball player that might have made the pros had you not gotten injured?
I would hope to think so. Yeah, I was touted. I had some professional tryouts. I had some, there's some where you're invited, some that you walk ons. So I went to several tryouts for several professional teams. I was looked at by different scouts, and yeah, I had a possibility of making at least a minor league ball. Yeah.
And you did some other legitimate things in your life early on. You worked in a delicatessen, I believe.
Yeah, I worked. I had, like most kids, you do the normal things, I guess, growing up as a child. I had newspaper routes. I worked in gas stations. I worked in liquor stores. I worked in a delicatessen about the 3 blocks from my house, which was a popular hangout spot, and also a delicatessen for the average person that's in the neighborhood doesn't know what goes on there, but they just come there and get their groceries and walk out. But for the people that were from the area, we knew it was much more than that then.
When was the first time in your childhood you became aware of organized crime, the mafia?
I guess I was about 5, 6 years old. My dad used to take me to the Bronx, where my uncle was involved in illegal card games, which were, back then, they were popular 3-card Monte games. And it was all wise guys and street guys in the back of a garage setting with a dummy elevator that just took you into a vaulted room, basically. And I was exposed to a lot of street guys and guys smoking cigars and throwing money around. And at that age, I started questioning and asking my dad who these guys were, because I seen the money flowing.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with John Alite, former mob enforcer for the Gambino family, who has now turned his life around and is living a legitimate life, and I commend you for that. So you became aware, really as a child, about the mob and the money associated with the mob and the lifestyle. How did you first get your start working with the mob? I assume you were doing little things for them?
Yeah, I was working in a deli, and there was sports rackets that were run out of the back of the delicatessen. Next door was a car service that my young girlfriend, we were kids, father ran. And around the corner from that was his brother, who was a Lucchese-made guy, that were running a bookmaking operation, numbers. And they would run it off the payphones, partially out of the deli where I was working, called Dick's Delicatessen. And I started running paperwork and money back and forth across the street next door for him.
And there came a time when ultimately you met John Gotti Jr. Can you describe how you met him and how you developed a relationship with the Gottis?
Yeah, I was, like I said, a baseball player, and I was boxing at a place called Lost Battalion Hall up on Queens Boulevard, and I was involved with Albert Ruggiano at the time, who was Fat Andy Ruggiano's son, who was the man in our neighborhood at that time. He was a powerful skipper, and which is a captain in the Gambino family. So my exposure was to that family initially. And then through some mutual friends and people, I ran into John Gotti Jr. And when Fat Andy Ruggiano went to prison, John Gotti Sr. stepped in his shoes. And from there, I hung around his son on, somewhat of a friendly basis. And then slowly you get involved with him and his family.
Now, this book, Gotti's Rules, The Story of John Alite Jr. Gotti and the Demise of the American Mafia, authored by George Anastasia. Tell us a little bit about why you agreed to provide Mr. Anastasia with the information to write this book. Why were you interested in this project?
Well, when I was in prison, I guess it was about 1997, I was a cellmate with Jeannie Gotti, John Gotti Sr.'s brother. And there were some things that were going on with John Gotti Jr. that I didn't think was... I started having questioning if he was a cooperator. When I was in Brazil at the time, this is now fast-forwarding a little bit to 2004, 2005, there was rumors he was cooperating. John Gotti Jr. went on trial several times and beat the cases. So when I come back from Brazil, they extradite me back. John Gotti Jr. is all over 60 Minutes and news, and I cooperated against him in a case. I testified against him. Excuse me, I didn't cooperate against him. I testified against him in a case in about 2008 or 9. But unbeknownst to most people, he was already cooperating. We had paperwork that he was a cooperator and that we call a rat, a snitch, an informer. And he got on 60 Minutes accusing other guys of ratting against him and cooperating. He belittled me and my family, and he got in the media, I believe it was 3 times on 60 Minutes, and I was annoyed at the way he was talking and the lies that were coming out and kids believing that this life is what it's about. And so when I came home out of prison, I decided that it was time to out him and, tell the public really the truth of what went on and show the documents that I had that he was really a rat the whole time, and which we call a CI. And in legal terms, for people don't know, it's a guy that goes in, profits with the government on a secret without anybody knowing, and they call it Queen of the Day. And that's what he did. And so he did that 3 years prior to me ever coming in to testify against him. And when I had that information, I knew I was going to come home and testify against him because he was already ratting.
Now, for our listeners, John, I just want people to know that the 302 FBI report of John Gotti Jr.'s proffer is included, I believe in full, in the book Gotti's Rules, starting on page 276 of the book. So anybody who's interested in the substance of that interview between John Gotti Jr. and the U.S. Attorney's Office, which occurred January 18th, 2005, I believe, between the prosecutors, John Gotti Jr. and his attorneys, can get the book and check out the FBI report on that, which is called the 302. Now, John, I'm going to, with your permission, I'm going to play a clip of about 30 seconds of tape from John Gotti talking on 60 Minutes about a confrontation he talks about in the courtroom between you and him. Is it all right if I play that clip?
Yeah, that's fine. Yep.
Okay, please play it, Mark.
Who said he had murdered 3 people on orders from Gotti?
There was a confrontation in the courtroom.
Right. Right.
With Mr. Alite.
Yeah, after he testified, he got off the stand and he walked towards me and he smiled and was laughing. And that's when I called him a punk and a dog. He always was a punk and a dog. He was a junkie. He was all of those things. A miscreant. He was a trash pill then. He's a trash pill now. He'll always be a trash pill.
Thank you.
That trial also ended with a hopelessly deadlocked jury.
Now, John, you've heard that clip before, correct?
I got to laugh. I saved that clip because a friend of mine jokes about it all the time and plays it for me as a joke. So it's a running running joke between some of my friends and myself. And, you know, I got to clarify. I'll explain that clip, but I got to clarify 302 to the public that really doesn't understand what a 302 is. And I'll break it down in layman terms so they understand some of this. In 1987, I'm going to correlate something for them to understand. 1987, John Gotti Sr. went on trial with Willie Boy Johnson. Willie Boy Johnson did the same exact thing John Gotti Jr. does. He goes in and he proffers, and he's a CI, and when they ask him to testify on the stand, he refuses. So he does exactly what John Gotti Jr. does, and he goes on trial. So when he goes on trial with John Gotti Sr., they beat the case, same as John Gotti Jr. does. He doesn't want to testify or get on stand. He doesn't consummate his deal. He goes on trial. He beats his case also. In 1988, when Willie Boy Johnson comes home from prison, after beating the trial with John Gotti Sr., John Gotti Sr. orders the murder of Willie Boy Johnson from being a rat. John Gotti Jr., in a 302 I give, is also on that hit team. He claimed to me that he was a backup driver waiting around the corner while his father ordered that murder of Willie Boy Johnson. So if his father was alive today, he would order that same murder. You would tell me to kill his son for what he did, just the way he killed Willie Boy Johnson. We understand in the mob world that he's a rat. We understand John Gotti Jr. is a rat. So he can spin that conversation anywhere he wants. As far as calling me now to that tape, a dog, a miscreant, and these names, this is exactly why I came out with these papers. So the world would understand that this guy is not capable of telling the truth. He lied several times on 60 Minutes, and he spun the story now. He denied it in those days that he was ever a rat, that he ever profited, that there was ever a 302. When the fact that I brought it out, the 302, he changed the story a second time. Now recently he changed it a third time to it was just a fake, and I was just playing the government. Now, if that's true, his lawyer, Charlie Tenisi, who's just as bad as him, he's a lawyer just like him, and, you know, this is a legal show, so we'll explain that. He has two brothers, Charlie Tenisi, who are also disbarred as attorneys for illegal actions. And Charlie Tenisi is going to be a third, I would believe, and follow his brother's footsteps and be disbarred for his
life. Why do you believe that? Why do you believe that?
Because Charlie Tenisi, in the courtroom, Charlie Tenisi can advocate against me, and that's fine. I respect him as an attorney in a courtroom. But when he comes and he hits the streets and he lies to the public and he's his flunky and his puppet on different shows, when that's the man that released his 302s, he's the one that released those 302s against John Gotti Jr. to another skipper in our family, and that's how those papers surfaced. Charlie Tenisi, as well as John Gotti Jr., been on TV several times denying these 302s. Now they're asking for an investigation of a 302 that they claim was a lie. So what are they asking for exactly? Then there is no need to ask for an investigation if they say the 302s are a lie and they're fake. And if they did exist and they were fake, why didn't John Gotti Jr. put those 302s in his book to sell that book that he's trying to push so hard? So
John, let me stop you just for 1 second to so we're clear for the listeners. So you're alleging that the 302 of the interview in 2005 between John Gotti Jr. and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, that was a document that was provided by John Gotti Jr.'s lawyer, Charles Carnesi, to a captain of one of the five families?
Correct. Our family.
Who was it given to?
It was given to his prior client, Danny Marino. Danny Marino was Charlie Tenisi's client for years prior to John Gotti Jr. So, in other words, there could be 500 pages of 302s against John Gotti Jr. The only reason that these papers got loose is because his attorney, whose loyalty was to Danny Marino at the time, supplied them. He flew to Florida and met with the skipper of our family and gave those 302s. Now, John Gotti Jr.
Who is Danny Marino?
He's a captain in the Gambino family. He is one of the guys mentioned that Juan Gotti Jr. rats on in those 302s when he prophesied.
And Danny Marino gave the 302 to George Anastasia or to you or to
No. Danny, what he does is he gives those 302s to Danny Marino. Danny Marino, as a skipper of the Gambino family, does the right thing, and he gives it to our administration. Our administration, meaning the hierarchy of the Gambino family, our commission of guys on the board, which at that time were the Carrazzo brothers. And from there, they distributed to who they believed was necessary to see those papers, depending on who was fighting cases, I believe, at that time, which I'm in a Brazilian penitentiary, you know, fighting for my life, and John Gotti Jr. is giving me up in a courtroom having a sandwich and a beer in a prosecutor's office. So while I'm in the dungeons in Brazil, Danny Marino is fighting for his life. Joe Watts is fighting for his life. John Gotti Jr. is giving everybody up on murders.
Now, John, tell me, I've read this book, Gotti's Rules, and I encourage everybody to go get it. It's available at Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble, other bookstores. It's a very interesting read about the evolution of the American mafia. John, tell us something that the public doesn't know, something that is not included in the book that the public should know.
Well, the public should know that this family shouldn't be glamorized. They're looking at the mafia, and if you want to look at some of the respect that we were supposed to be known for, it's not the respect of killing. And John will spin this also. He did recently on CNN. The questions weren't asked that should have been asked. Is there respect of a man, his uncle Vincent Gotti, that kills a girl and rolls her up and puts her in a carpet and throws her in a garbage can in Brooklyn? That's not anything to do with the mafia. Is there anything to do with the mafia when his father has the order of a next-door neighbor killed for running over his little brother by accident? I mean, it was an accident. It's a terrible tragedy for a young boy or anybody's family losing a child. And, I won't change that fact. But you don't kill a next-door neighbor that's not involved with the mob. He's not a drunk. That was rumors that were put out about the man. And he was not only killed, he was dismembered and tortured and put in a can of acid, a barrel of acid. That's not part of the mafia. John Gotti Jr. killing and stabbing a 16-year-old kid from behind in a bar of Silver Fox and bragging about it, that's not part of the mafia. That's not what we're about. And when people lose and the people in the public are following this family and this legendary nonsense that's out about them, this is the stuff they need to understand and realize. This isn't men of honor. This isn't men of respect. We're drug dealers. We were killers. But we're not killing innocent people, which this family has done, and women. And I don't know who these people out in the public that are following this. They need to understand this has nothing to do with, this is a spin of the Gottis, that this is not out in the public eye more. They should understand what this family's been about. And this nonsense that we don't kill for drugs and we're not involved in drugs and the Gotti family isn't. Paul Castellano was murdered in front of Sparks just because of the heroin trade and the money that was brought in. That was done by John Gotti Sr.'s orders. He was on the scene. Sammy Gravano testified about this. And Gene Gotti was one of the reasons that Paul Castellano was killed. It was my cellmate in 1997. And he discussed this heroin business with me in there. He was convicted to a 50-year term of sentence. So this nonsense that Gotti gets on TV and discusses, where's these questions by CNN commentators or newspapers that these people, these kids that want to follow this life, don't understand? And I'm here to explain this to them because I ruined my life following this nonsense and believing in this legend that doesn't exist. And while guys like me are out shooting and killing people, this guy gets on the news and calls me a miscreant and a dog. But he sits at home under his covers while the work is being done by guys like me. So, you know, kids got to understand.
John, can you tell our listeners what crimes you committed while you were in the Gambino family?
I committed every crime you could possibly think of. I was a drug dealer. I was a shooter for the Gambino family. I admitted to 37 shootings in court. The Gotti's claim and his lawyer, Charlie Canisi, claimed it was more like 50, I believe, or 40 or 50 or 60. I'm not sure what number he used. I said possibly. I admitted to about 6 murders and conspiracies. I said I could have been possibly involved in 15 murders. I was involved in over 100 baseball batting beatings and stabbings. And I was a dangerous guy on the street, and this is what they had me do every day. John Gotti Jr. and his lawyer said I killed for his father, John Gotti Sr., in court. When I come to the street, they got a different tune. So they're not sure what their story is because exactly it's a story with them. So the public
did you ever beat up or kill somebody who wasn't part of the life, part of the organized crime business?
No, I don't have any bad crimes like them. Never killed a woman, never hurt a woman like that. I never killed an outsider, a next-door neighbor. I never killed a young kid. My business was strictly with people that were involved in the street business and the mob. And there's no excuse for that either, so I don't want to make light of that. You know, I've tried to apologize to a lot of these families, and, some people accept them, some people don't. I got to live with that every day. It's something that tortures my mind. And it's not an easy thing to live with, and I'm really I'm the hardest judge of myself for that, and it's a difficult thing that the kids don't see, and I'm trying to stray some kids away and have the confidence to overcome anything they're thinking about and become good guys and grow up and go to work and do what you're doing, all the individuals.
Well, John, when did you first start cooperating with the government?
Well, I first testified against Junior Gotti, which I didn't cooperate. Like I said, he was a rat already. So, that wasn't cooperation. My cooperation after that fact was I had some guys in our mob, the hierarchy, that okayed other guys testifying against me. One was an opening statement by a Ronnie One-Armed Truccio during the trials in Florida. He blamed everything on me. His lawyer was Joseph Carrazzo, the son of the consigliere of the family. So he okayed the Ronnie One-Armed statements against me. The acting underboss was Nicky Carrazzo. He okayed the statements of Ronnie One-Armed against me. And that's when I had enough of the treachery of the mob, and I decided, okay, I'll come in and I'll give whatever information there is against them. So they opened the door, and I finished closing it, and it's the best thing I ever did in my life, to be honest with you.
Isn't one of the Gotti's rules that if you become a witness, that the penalty is death, which is issued by the mafia?
Exactly, and that's another Gotti's rules that's broken. He became a cooperator, and I don't want to be kind with that word cooperator because he wasn't kind to other people. He's a miscreant, he's a dog, and he's a punk, and he was supposed to go for ratting. And one of my initial reasons to come in and cooperate against other guys were when I was in Brazil and I asked them to kill him, they didn't want to kill him because there was too much paperwork out there. They didn't know who he implicated. So guys didn't want to take a chance. So they shelved him, what they call kicked him out of the mob, and he's not recognized. And that was his penalty. But another Gotti rule that was broken, along with his uncle Vinny Gotti that killed the girl. These guys are supposed to be killed for what they're doing.
Now, John, I assume that the witness protection program was made available to you since you testified in open court against John Gotti Jr. and, I guess, others. How come you declined the protection of that program?
I wanted to live my life on my terms. I wanted to out what was going on in his life and in the mob and to show people that the guys like John Gotti Jr. are cowards, and it's not the person to follow, and it's fake. And I live my life on my terms, and I want to be the guy that's out here doing the right thing and live the second part of my life, teaching kids to stay off the streets, not do this, not follow it in mob life, gang life, or any kind of street life. It's a dead end, and they don't see the pain that goes with it. So, I want to teach some kids to follow my lead and be brave, and be brave by doing the right thing. Join the Army if you want to be a hero. Become a cop. Become a fireman. But don't go to the street. It's fake. It's false. It's not what the people think it is.
John, how can people get in touch with you if they want to hire you to do consulting with kids, and I think you do some other. Do you do some other corporate consulting you're trying to do?
Yeah, I do some motivational speaking. I mean, I had I was wealthy at one time. I owned a lot of properties. I owned about 16 properties, and I was well off, and I lost it. And you know, I'm a fighter, and I got back off the ground, and I do some motivational speaking about how to have confidence and rebuild your life and move forward no matter where you're at. And I've been to the penthouse, and I've been to the basement, and I'm working my way back up to the penthouse, and I'm teaching other people that it's possible to do what I did and do it the right way this time around.
So well, they can reach I encourage people to you have a really fascinating story. I encourage people to visit John, J-O-H-N, Alite, A-L-I-T-E.com to get more information about our very interesting guest, John Alite. John, thank you very much for coming on the show. I wish you lots of luck going forward, and I hope you'll come back on the show sometime in the future.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Okay, John, take care now. Before we get to Beth Karras, we are going to do the question of the day. The question of the day is, why did the United States Department of Justice, on the one hand, decide not to prosecute civil rights violations against former Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of Michael Brown, and on the other hand, conclude that the Ferguson Police Department needs to be reformed because of a pattern and practice of illegal, unconstitutional, and discriminatory conduct? Now, give me Beth.
Beth, what can I do?
Talking Law Radio brings you a live Karras on Crime special report from Beth Karras, former prosecutor, Court TV, HLN television correspondent, and founder of KarrasOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news.
Beth, what can I do?
Welcome home, Beth.
Well, thank you. I had a long ride overnight. Didn't get a lot of sleep.
Well, I really appreciate you sacrificing sleep to be on the show this morning. I know that you were flying, and we have a lot to talk about. And I want to congratulate you for sticking it out for all those many months in Maricopa County, Arizona, doing such a great job giving us the inside information on the Jody Arias penalty phase retrial. So, Beth, what happened yesterday? What's the big news?
I was getting ready for court and got a text from one of the other bloggers who was there, and she said, you better get down here early because something's going on. The attorneys have all gone into court, and that was like 8:30. Court's supposed to start at 9:30. Well, start, I mean, jurors come to resume day six of deliberations. But the attorneys showed up early. The family members on both sides, Jody Arias and the victim, Travis Alexander, were showing up. So I dropped everything, left my bowl of cereal on the table, and headed to court, which was minutes away, but I got there early. And indeed, there was quite a buzz in the air. Shortly after I arrived, the court tweeted out, this is the court public information officer, that a verdict would be read at 9:30. So I'm texting all my media friends saying, get down here, we got action. So obviously something had happened the night before, and it turns out the jurors had submitted a note the night before saying that they continue to be deadlocked. They were at an impasse. Basically, they were going to sleep on it. Their next note to the judge yesterday morning said, basically, we've slept on it, and nothing has changed. So what they called a verdict, they did this last time in the penalty phase, too, 2 years ago. They said a verdict had been reached, which to me means unanimity in a decision. It was a deadlock. I guess it meant finality. You know, the judge was going to accept their impasse and declare a mistrial. So everybody, the courtrooms fall, and the jurors file in. Family members on both sides were already crying, which now makes sense because the note indicated what, you know, the verdict sheet was going to show. You wouldn't typically put a verdict in a note. Jurors wouldn't. So the court wouldn't know. The families wouldn't know a verdict, life or death. And it was all over very quickly when the judge read the notes, declared a mistrial, thanked them for their service. One of Travis Alexander's sisters, three sisters were present and a brother, was bent over sobbing. Two of them were sobbing, but one, like, really audibly. And it was her sobs were, like, echoing in this cavernous courtroom. And the judge was not stopping it, and no deputies were asking her to leave. It was just, she just kept sobbing as the proceedings continued, and the judge thanked them. As the jurors filed out, and the judge had said, you're free now to talk, thank you for your service, blah, 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 I saw jurors crying. One of them, one of the women, put her hand over her heart and you know, made a motion like sorry, looking directly at the Alexander family. And the jurors had to file past them. You know, they were closer. The side of the courtroom they sat on, where the prosecutor often sits, is the side closest to the jury. And the family ended up, you know, not talking. They have a civil attorney. At least at that point, they weren't talking. So we were all, like, scrambling out to see if the jurors are going to talk, which indeed they did. It took about an hour, and we thought, well, we heard that one, at least one juror is going to speak. I was sitting in that room, which was an overflow media room set up only for the media, not members of the public, in this jury interview. Meanwhile, the prosecutor's office held a press conference, and, you know, stuff's happening out front. But I'm parked in a seat ready to talk to jurors, because to me, that's the most important thing. We've heard from the lawyers. We know, we can predict, you know, what each side in terms of you know, family members would say. I want to hear from those jurors. I want to know what happened. And all of them came except for the holdout. Of course, I've left out the headline. The deadlock was 11 for death, and it was a deadlock for a week. Last Wednesday, they reached that. So we talked to the jury, the media, for quite a long time until there were just basically no more questions. I thought I counted 13 jurors. I know there was a woman who was excused because her mother passed away unexpectedly a week ago, and she wanted to come and be there for the verdict, so she sat with the two alternates. One alternate, that juror who had been excused, and I don't know that I saw the third alternate, and then all 11 who had voted for death came. I mean, wow. I've seen it sometimes.
Beth, the whole jury will talk.
Beth,
have we identified the one holdout juror who voted not to impose a death penalty?
Yes.
Is that a female or a male?
Female.
Okay, and was she interviewed?
No. She did not talk, and I understand that police were at her house last night just for protection. Because her name got out there, and only the lawyers knew the names, and somehow her name got out there. And I'm telling you, the defense wasn't releasing it. Somehow it got out there, and these jurors were known by numbers, and they were anonymous. But now all the names are out, I understand. Of course, I was flying last night, so, you know, stuff was happening as I was at the airport, and I couldn't follow everything. But her name got released. I knew her name before the press conference with the jurors. Never said her name or much about her. But I have details about her because I was at jury selection, and I looked at my notes. She was in seat number 17, and she's divorced from a man who was abusive. She was psychologically abused. She called him a bully. This is all from jury selection. He did time. He went to prison. She used to bring their little kids she brought the little kids to visit him three or four times. She's married now to somebody who had also done time, but not anymore. He's gainfully employed. He's construction or something. And she was asked whether or not these cases would affect her impression, assessment of law enforcement. She said no. I don't know, frankly, why Juan Martinez kept her. Anyway, the jurors who voted for death said that, they said she didn't deliberate. I don't know that that's true that she didn't deliberate, but she said that, you know, the death penalty, she accused them of using the death penalty as revenge. And she never told them about her domestic violence background. And I asked the jurors that, are you aware of this, that maybe she's projecting and seeing this abusive ex-husband, shadows of him in the allegations of abuse by the victim in this case, which all the other jurors rejected. But, they, I mean, the victim did use pretty strong language.
Beth, we have like 30 seconds left, and there's a couple things I want to make sure we hit. Number one, can you tell our listeners what the sentence possibilities are now in light of the hung jury?
With a second deadlock on the penalty phase, this defaults to a life sentence. You only get two shots in Arizona. Life is natural life. They don't call it life without parole because they don't have parole. But they have an alternative life with the possibility of release after 25 years, but no procedure in place at the moment for that. So that's really academic. It'll be a natural life sentence, I'm sure. This judge will not give her this with the possibility of release after 25 years. She goes into her own cell, 6 by 8 feet, in any event, for the next 2 years. And then she can work her way with good behavior to getting a cellmate. But she can start participating in group activities in 30 days after she's sentenced on April 13th.
Beth Karras, KarrasOnCrime.com. Beth, go get some sleep. Thanks so much for doing the show this morning. I appreciate it as always.
My pleasure.
Take care. Now, for the answer to the question of the day. The question of the day is, why did the United States Department of Justice, on the one hand, decide not to prosecute civil rights violations against former Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of Michael Brown, and on the other hand, conclude that the Ferguson Police Department needs to be reformed because of a pattern and practice of illegal, unconstitutional, and discriminatory conduct? The answer is, these are two separate investigations which are only related in that the pattern and practice investigations was triggered by widespread protests and tension following the death of Black Michael Brown by white officer Wilson. The Department of Justice declined to prosecute Wilson because the credible evidence consisting of Officer Wilson's testimony, 3 autopsy reports, crime scene evidence, and eyewitness statements supported the conclusion that Wilson acted in an objectively reasonable manner in shooting Brown 6 to 8 times. The evidence also established that Wilson did not willfully violate Brown's civil rights, but rather was justified in defending himself from Brown's attack while Wilson was seated inside his car and on the street when Brown moved towards Wilson. The keys to the no federal prosecution decision in the Officer Wilson case boiled down to a lack of evidence to prove even by a preponderance of the evidence that Wilson violated Brown's civil rights or intended to violate federal law in shooting Brown. As for the pattern and practice finding against the Ferguson Police Department, this was based on findings that quota systems employed by the Ferguson Police Department and the local courts essentially created a revolving door of poor blacks who were issued multiple citations for minor offenses, which resulted in a series of warrants and incarceration for failure to pay fines, which many poor blacks could not afford to pay. The feds also found statistically significant evidence of blacks being stopped and searched more than whites, found excessive force used against blacks more than whites, and a pattern and practice of arresting those attempting to exercise their First Amendment rights by recording police activity or voicing public dissent of police action. I want to thank John Alite for appearing on the show. Go to johnalite.com, johnalite.com, to find out more about his fascinating story from being a college baseball player to being an enforcer for the Gambino family. I want to thank Beth Karras, KarrasOnCrime.com, for giving us the latest about the hung jury and the Jody Arias case. My producer, Mark Goldman, thanks. Great job as always. Next week, we have Sidney Powell, former Department of Justice attorney and author of Licensed to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice. That's our show for today. Tune in next week to hear our guest, Sidney Powell. Next week, Wednesday, 9:30 a.m., I wish everybody peace and justice. And now I got to run to a bat mitzvah. Out.